I'm George Wacker with Lehigh Valley Would Love.
And I'm Northampton County Commissioner Jeff Warren.
Welcome to Off the Record with Lehigh Valley Would Love, where we dive into the real topics shaping our community, from mental health to warehouses, local businesses to community events. If it matters to the Lehigh Valley, we're talking about it.
That's right. Each episode, we'll sit down with local experts, leaders, and community members to explore the issues that impact our lives. Some topics are so big, they're actually going to span multiple episodes. This isn't just another podcast. It's a conversation about what makes the Lehigh Valley tick. So let's get started.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Off the Record with Lehigh Valley Would Love. I'm your co-host, George Wacker, with my co-host and Northampton County Commissioner, Jeff Warren. And today, we are joined by former Lehigh Valley Congresswoman, Susan Wild. Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to. Thanks.
So, first question, though, Jeff, we have to ask before we get into anything is, we were wondering if there's any news that you can share with us about your future plans when it comes to your political future?
I was afraid you were going to ask me to comment on the news of the day, which
so skip that.
Thanks for not asking me about the Zelensky meeting in the White House. Let me tell you where I am right now. And this is not just puffery, but I will say that it really was just the most wonderful experience of my life representing the 7th District and the I loved the Lehigh Valley long before I became a member of Congress, but those 6 years that I was in Congress really just made me so aware of all these great groups and organizations and people in the Lehigh Valley. So right now, my focus has been very much on continuing to be an advocate for the community. And by the way, I don't think there's any time like the present, given everything that's happening with the Trump administration, because I think that some of our amazing charitable and philanthropic organizations are going to be pressed into service and need more than they ever have been. So I've been doing a lot of outreach. I've already had a lot of outreach to me in terms of how I can amplify, whether it's fundraising for them, whether it's just talking to them about strategy and that kind of thing. So I'm really committed to that right now. I'm also, this is an election year, 2025. It's an off year, as they say, but nobody should ever think any year is an off year. The judicial races, both at the state level, there are some state Supreme Court justices up for retention, and there is one opening on the Commonwealth Court and the Superior Court, as well as some local judicial races are super important, and they tend to be races that the average person doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about. Plus, there's also some local races going on aside from the judicial. And so I'm really trying to focus on those, drive up turnout. And I haven't started the turnout drive yet because it's still too early. That's not until November's the election this year. It's always in November, but there will be some primaries and that kind of thing. And so that's where I've been really focused, helping good candidates who haven't been involved in politics, as well as just trying to motivate people and make them understand how important off-year elections are. So those are the two things I've really, really been committed to. And that's what I intend to continue to focus on for the coming months.
I really want to say thank you, though, Susan, really quick. When you talk about wanting to advocate for organizations that specifically know that they are going to have funding-based issues because of what's happening in Washington, I work for a nonprofit that helps foster youth in New Jersey. That is my full-time job. We just had a staff meeting today, and there is a lot of things that we are going to need to figure out over the course of these next year and even longer. And
hasn't really hit yet how bad it's going to be. And by the way,
I want to thank you, by the way, for that advocacy.
Thank you for thanking me. But I have to tell you, it's a very fulfilling mission that I have. And it's a feel good thing for me too, to help. But I failed to mention higher education. I will tell you, our great colleges and universities and even our community colleges are at great risk as well because of what's happening with the administration and, not to mention K-12 education. So there's a lot to be done, and you could literally make it a full-time job to just try to amplify these things. But just beyond that, a lot of people have asked me if I'm going to run next year for my old seat. And quite honestly, have not made that decision in a final kind of way yet. I think that it's really important that somebody run on the Democratic side who can beat Ryan McKenzie. He's already shown himself to be a rubber stamp for the Trump administration. He voted for that horrendous budget the other night. Not that I didn't expect him to, but you know, that's the one that's going to really set things in motion to really hurt people at where they feel it. And so I consider that to be a number one goal for next year. And I just have not, frankly, because of these other things I've been focused on, and also because, quite honestly, I'm enjoying life not as a candidate for a little bit of time. I've been a candidate for 7 years running.
Right.
And so I'm just trying to, you know, take a chill pill on that. And I'll make a decision in finality later on. But ultimately, if it's not me, I will be getting behind whoever the strongest Democratic candidate is to take on Ryan.
Well, Susan, you've done such great representation of the Lehigh Valley. And yes, I'm biased because I've been friends with you for a while. I'm actually looking at a photo of you and my daughters back in 2018 on election day that you signed for my daughters and I. Mm-hmm. But as we're moving along with the conversation here, you know, those of us who do run for public office, we usually have those moments where an issue or a specific moment in time helps to push you in the direction of running during an election. When you go back to that time in 2018, when you were thinking about running for Congress, what was the determining factor or the tipping point where you said, yes, you know what, I'm going to do this. I need to do this. Was there that moment in time for you, that light switch moment for you?
It's hard to call it a light switch moment that it was geared to specific happenings. Just to go back a little bit, it was something I had thought about for a long time. Charlie Dent was very much ensconced as our congressman. He was popular on both sides of the aisle. He was also a personal friend. And as I say this, my phone is showing me that Charlie Dent is calling me right now. We've great friends. I'll call
thanks,
him when we're
done. Thanks for not picking up right now. Thanks.
Patch him in.
Here we go, you know. Let me just say that, although I could pick up and then he could also weigh in here. But
I feel like Anderson Cooper right now.
Yeah, right? But I would not have run against Charlie Dent. He was a family friend. Fun fact that a lot of people know, his son and my daughter dated throughout high school. And in addition to that, you know, I could see that he was sort of the right kind of politician for the Lehigh Valley. So I had been thinking about it for a long time, but frankly, I thought Charlie would end up staying a lot longer than he did. When Charlie announced that he was going to step down or retire, that prompted very quick conversations within my family. But then what happened, and we were kind of weighing it, but then I started to get a lot of outreach from people in the community who had known me. And that encouraged me because, you know, one of the things that people running for a big office the first time often think is, why me? Can I do this? So when other people reach out to you, it is very much a, it's validation. But in addition to that, of course, Trump had been elected in 2016. We had seen we thought we saw what a disaster that was by 2017. Little did we know how bad the second term would be right from the get-go. And that was in no small part a motivating factor for me. But the other factors also very much weighed in. So it was all of those things combined.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned how you had, well, you're starting to have some time to yourself, I guess, to reflect and do that. What, when you are reflecting and you're looking back on your time in Congress, are there any accomplishments that stand out to you or things that maybe you're most proud about that we might not have noticed or might not have made the news? Or
yeah, there's a few things that I'm particularly proud of. First and foremost, you've probably noticed them, but collectively, I would say putting the Lehigh Valley on the map for folks in Washington. And by folks, I mean agencies that administer grants and that kind of thing. What I realized pretty quickly was that Pennsylvania, when it's under consideration for money from Washington, most of that money goes to Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And no disparagement of either of those cities. They're big, important cities. But guess what? We're the third largest region in Pennsylvania and the fastest growing region.
Yep.
And I felt that we were underrepresented in terms of federal dollars and that kind of thing. So that was my number one goal for the community. And I think I did a damn good job of it. I think, you know.
Yes, you did.
Just millions and millions of dollars flowed back to the Lehigh Valley, and we got some great things done and funded and that kind of thing. So I'm very proud of that. But when I ran, I also had a mission of working to reduce prescription drug prices. And that was something that came to me during my campaign, because nobody in my family, frankly, had had to suffer the fallout of high prescription drug prices. The family members who were on medications, they were on generic, relatively cheap. My father had been military. So for years, we had enjoyed the benefits of a military medical system. And my mother did all the way up until the time of her death, and was, you know, able to get her medications through the Air Force. So it hadn't really occurred to me until I started talking to people on the campaign trail. And the first thing that I really remember learning about was the high price of insulin. And it then, as I started to look into it, realizing how many people in our district need insulin, you know, they're diabetic and so forth. And then just looking into the pricing and the history of insulin and the fact that the inventor of insulin had intended it to be free because it was life-saving, and he had sold the patent to the federal government for $1 in the hopes that everybody would have access. And then lo and behold, here we were all these decades later, and people couldn't afford their insulin. So that's what really put the focus for me on prescription drug pricing. Really proud to say that I went there and made it my mission in terms of a legislative accomplishment to get something done. And in the 117th Congress, of course, through the IRA, you know, a lot of people laugh about that bill because it was named the Inflation Reduction Act, which was not a great name. But in fact, we made the first breakthrough on getting, first of all, insulin pricing down. And now for the two subsequent years, negotiating some other life-saving medications to bring their prices down. So I have to say, you know, that was a mission, and I was really proud of it. And in the beginning, of course, it only looked like we were going to get insulin down, and I wasn't sure anything. And I knew that that wasn't enough. But as we've continued with that, I've been really proud of that. And I just think that it's something that's really changed a lot of people's lives, the reduced pricing.
It absolutely has. I can say right now, as my mother gets insulin continuously, and it was a burden from a financial perspective, Susan, and that bill, that law has now helped her. And she's somebody who lives on Social Security. That's what she lives on. And it has helped her significantly. But, you know, as we're moving along here, you know, I wanted to get into a few more topics with you.
Go ahead.
And I'm not the biggest cable news fan, but there's a cable news host on MSNBC, Chris Hayes. He recently came out with a book called The Siren's Call, and it explores the battle political figures have with claiming attention of the public, and how this really is a detriment to the nation's governing practices. And I recently heard an interview with him where he said, like, we actually shouldn't be calling this the information age that we're living in anymore. It should be called the attention age that we are living in. So this is all, you know, some background to me asking you, and I'm wondering, how have you seen this change over the years during your time while you were in Congress and throughout your campaigns in Congress, when political figures are doing all they can to keep voters' attention instead of actually, like, getting down to governing and providing real and truthful information to our citizenry? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, people often ask me, what's the root of all evil and why is this country so divided and what can we do to fix it? And my answer is, well, we need to get rid of the internet. To which, and I say it very dryly and people look stunned. And then I say, I'm only kidding. We're never getting rid of the internet. But obviously, you know, that was the start of but that has perpetuated a lot of really bad practices and policies. And we're going to somehow have to rein those in. But beyond the internet, I will say the biggest problem in politics is the amount of money that flows into particularly federal politics, and especially since the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, the cost, and you guys have probably seen and read what my race last year cost all in on both sides plus outside money, a $38 million race for Congress in one seat in not a particularly wealthy district is obscene. Let's face it, that money, think about what we could do with that money. Sure. But as a result, and I am getting to the answer to your question, as a result of how much money it takes, especially in the tough districts, but politics in general, for the parties, for people across the spectrum, whether they're in a safe district or not, because of the amount of money it takes, people, specifically candidates, are rewarded if they can go viral.
Yeah.
So I will tell you, somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez does not have to spend 1 minute on the phone raising money. Why? Because she goes viral and she gets so many small dollar donors that, she raises huge amounts of money in a district where she doesn't really need to raise that much. But as a result, she funds a lot of other candidates and that kind of thing. And she's just one example. There's examples on both sides of the aisle. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, some of the craziest stuff that you've seen out of members of Congress this year, suggesting that Donald Trump's birthday should be a national holiday, that we need to put him on the $250 bill.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of things that are being done because there is a base that will love those ideas. And we'll send in your $10 or $5 or $25. And it's not a few people. It's a lot of people. And those people will. So even though none of those people that are behind those policies I mentioned are in tough districts, they will raise millions of dollars. And so there is a huge incentive to get in there and go viral and to be provocative. And one of the problems is, number one, take me as an example. Somebody in a district like mine does not get, first of all, cable news, there's most of the stuff I was working on isn't sexy enough for cable news to put out a hit with Susan Wild. Or even if they do, what I have to talk about, what we need to do to train more certified nurses aides. People are like, okay, yawn. it's just not something that really gets people's juices going. And so people in the tougher districts are less likely to be seen on cable news, number one. Number two, they are often not rewarded for being on cable news by their constituents, who, of course, are the only ones who can vote them into office. And so they tend to shy away from controversial things that would get a lot of tickets. So it all comes back to this money issue in politics. If they weren't being richly rewarded for being the subject of attention, they wouldn't do it. Now, obviously, there's always going to be a few people, vanity projects, people who just love to see themselves, on TV or on social media. But it is largely driven by people wanting to raise millions and millions of dollars.
It's a great answer. And like you were just saying, there are certain issues that should be getting the attention that they, like you said, with regard to the nursing issue. County Council last week, I had the Penn State Agricultural Extension come and talk to us about the avian bird flu situation and how that is affecting our communities. It got no play at all in terms of the media, but it was great that county. Yeah.
I got a bipartisan bill signed by Donald Trump in his first administration on certified nurses aides that I sponsored with a Republican from Pennsylvania. Zero play, even though it was during COVID when we had no certified nurses aides were desperately needed in nursing homes.
Yeah.
Zero play because it's kind of like,
That's not very interesting. Yeah.
Unless people can scream at each other about it, it's not something they want to put on there.
Well, that's a good point, George, because let me just say bipartisanship is not rewarded either, because what they really want to see is politicians. People say they can't stand how this stuff going on in Congress. The fact of the matter is the reward is attention, TV spots and all that stuff. And it's
and without getting into the weeds of it, just what happened in Lehigh County with the district attorney getting
for
support. You know, that's a great example of it. So switching bait a little bit. You've represented the Lehigh Valley and you've met probably more people than anybody in the Lehigh Valley in that time, right? Or arguably.
I would say so.
If you had to tell somebody who's never been to the Lehigh Valley or never met anybody from it, what are the people in the Lehigh Valley like? What is your answer?
I would tell that person as a candidate, before they even get elected, that this is a population that it works hard. Most of them work for a paycheck that they very much depend on. They want to hear common sense and sensible arguments and solutions to problems that actually affect them, that they are not as motivated by national party messages as maybe some areas are, and that actually showing up is hugely important, not only because you'll be seen, but because if you're smart, you will stick around after you've made your remarks. You will shake a whole lot of hands and you will let people talk and you will listen to them. I mean, I gave you the example earlier of my passion for the prescription drug pricing. I only learned about that from talking to people and listening to what they had to say, because it wasn't something that had ever personally affected me. That is critically, critically important for anybody running for office. And by the way, that applies to local office, county council, and everything else.
Yep.
If it's somebody who is, once they've been elected, my most important piece of advice would still be show up, talk to people, don't be afraid of them disagreeing with you or even yelling at you, because they will give you credit for showing up and listening to them. And maybe you'll change some views, maybe you won't, based on what they say. But the worst thing you can do is go hide in a closet.
Mm-hmm. That is a fantastic, and that has been my experience ever since I was, when 2007, when I was elected Easton City Council. I disagreed with what, whether it was the Panto administration or even residents of the city wanted to do. But when you show up, when you're at meetings, when you are talking to people on their front porches about issues that are important to them, it's not just about changing somebody's ideas or changing somebody's philosophies. People want a voice. People want to be heard at the end of the day. And I think that's just critically, critically important.
They want to be respected. So
absolutely.
I've watched some town halls where a member of Congress has asked something about, say, potholes. And rather than, I mean, obviously whoever's asking that question must have a real problem with some potholes somewhere. Yeah. That's not under the purview of Congress. And I've heard people respond to that question or a similar question in such a condescending manner, like, we don't have anything to do with potholes, as opposed to hearing the person out, even asking, where in particular have you noticed really bad? And then either saying something like, well, let me get in touch with the Allentown Transportation. You know, I'm a member of Congress. I can call them and they'll pay attention to me, or giving them a phone number to call. But the condescension that you see often is really extraordinary. And I've just never understood it. And people really want to know that their concerns are being heard.
Yes, absolutely.
I'll tell a quick story. I'll always love Lisa Boscola, because when I was in college, my license plate, something happened to it on my car and I didn't know what to do. I went to their office and they helped me out. And it was totally like not something that they would normally handle. So.
The number one thing I loved when I was in Congress was random people that I did not know would see me at the grocery store or Target or something. They come up to me and they go, this person in your office locally helped me. I've been waiting for my IRS refund for 4 years and I can't get through to the IRS and they got it for me in 30 days. Just stuff like that. Yeah. And that was always music to my ears. That was my favorite kind of response.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a staff person to State Senator Lisa Boscola for over 13 years, and it was one of the most rewarding parts of the job when you were able to cut through that red tape.
hugely difficult because a lot of people call you in frustration or they're angry. And having good staffers, good team, super important.
Absolutely. When you can cut through that red tape and actually get something done for somebody, it's a fantastic feeling. Fantastic. But I also wanted to, you know, as we're, you know, getting ready to finish up our discussion here, Susan, I really wanted to talk to you about where the party is like, look, there's no secret. You're a Democrat. I'm a Democrat. But there is a perception that our party, the Democratic Party, has become, from a leadership standpoint in Washington, a quote, older party, you know, kind of slow to embrace the younger leaders. And while I think there have been steps taken, like, for instance, Nancy Pelosi taking a step back, supporting Hakeem Jeffries for House leadership. I'm wondering, do you believe the party should be doing more to kind of pass that baton to the younger generation?
I sure as hell do. And by the way, if I decide I'm not going to run next year, it's going to be because I practice what I preach. And I believe in mentoring people and passing the baton, as you say, and making sure that we're getting good people. And some of the best members of Congress that I served with were really young. And it, you know, they might have things they needed to learn. And I would hope that some of them didn't have as much life experience as others of us did, but they also had a unique window into what younger people are thinking. And by the way, when I'm talking about a place like Congress, it's not just an age thing. Although I do think people in Congress need to learn when to retire. I really, really, really strongly feel that way. And all credit goes to Nancy Pelosi for stepping down voluntarily when she did. I wish more people would take her example and not, instead what we've had in our party is some embarrassing situations where older people have been forced out of a committee chairmanship or whatever, because people in the caucus are like, yeah, you're still very smart, but you're too old. And nobody wants to, I mean, I would never want to be in that situation, you know. And long ago, I told my kids, my adult kids, if I ever get to that point and I'm still there, would you please just come and haul me home and tell me it's time to get out of politics? Right. But anyway, I do think and by the way, this is not unique to Democrats. It's just that it's less acceptable on the Democratic side. Because when I would be on the House floor looking over, and this floor is not actually divided between Democrats and Republicans, but the Democrats always gravitated to one side and Republicans to the others. But you could sit wherever you wanted. But if I looked across at the Republican side, their average age was far older than the average age of the Democratic caucus. And I guess that's okay with their base. But the Democratic caucus is our, you know, we're a big tent party. We have a lot of young people who have looked to us over the years.
Yeah.
Who are losing faith in us because they don't feel like they are personally represented well enough in Congress. I was always, some of the support that I was proudest of came from college students. And I, like, to me, or even Jeff, I got to tell you, when I would take a picture with your daughters, or would visit with young people. I went to elementary schools all the time and talked to elementary schools, and my team, because time is precious when you're in Congress, my team would always be like, you know, they can't vote yet, right? And my answer was, I don't care. I want to talk to these kids. I want to inspire them. I want them to think about public service. And so I will say, I feel like I was pretty good at keeping my finger on the pulse of the younger generation. But having said that, they also need fair representation. And so, that means mentoring them. That means creating a bench. And that bench could very well be created by, I'm not going to use the word grooming because that's got a bad connotation now.
Yeah,
but that could be done by mentoring people who might not be ready to run this year, next year, but talking to them. And in fact, it's one of my ambitions. I've been in a very busy period of time since I left Congress. One of the things I am absolutely adamant about doing is creating something in the Lehigh Valley that will be younger, talking to younger people, bringing in electeds for them to hear from, talking to high school kids, community college students, that kind of thing, to get them excited about a future and telling them, you don't have to run, even into, but get proximate to politics. work on a campaign, you know, run for something at some point. So anyway, I do think that our party would benefit. Some of the best members of Congress right now, in my view, are some of the youngest. Maxwell Frost out of Florida, who probably is not as well known to most people. He was the first Gen Zer elected to Congress. He came to D.C. and had driven for Uber. I mean, that's what he was doing while he was campaigning because he couldn't have a full-time job. He literally couldn't get an apartment for a couple of months because he didn't have any money in the bank. He was couch surfing with people like me and other members, you know, until he could afford to get an apartment. Which is, I mean, that's kind of a sad statement, but at the same time, it gives you an idea of his youth. He had no savings built up. But yet he's turned out to be one of the finest members of Congress. And guess what? If he had been deterred from running by the fact that he was young and he thought you had to be older and he thought you had to have like some great employment history to run, we wouldn't have the benefit of Maxwell in Congress right now.
Yeah.
And so I use him as an example because some of our younger members tend to be more controversial, but those are only the ones that you all know, that your listeners know, because cable highlights them.
Sure.
There are a whole bunch that came in the last few years who are also younger. Brittany Peterson, who was just made famous because she just gave birth to her second child and the Republicans wouldn't let her vote remotely.
So right, I just read that.
She brought her month-old child to the House floor and voted. Good for her. You know, I mean, because we need to see that. And so the answer is, in short, we need more people who are not career politicians. We need, but the people who have been in politics, whether it's me or Charlie Dent or other electeds, who need to be helping to build that bench, because we can't just say, go for it, you're on your own, because guess what? It is a brutal world out there to run for politics, to run for office.
Oh, so, you ain't just whistling Dixie.
What was that?
I said, you ain't just whistling Dixie. I know.
Exactly. So I hope that is, and I've given that message, by the way, to leadership in Washington. I've talked to them about the fact that we can't just say, yeah, let's get people like Max Frost to run. We have to get in there and we have to give them the kind of support they need. And I'm not just talking money. I'm talking about the moral support, the encouragement.
Sure.
That kind of thing. And so, but and even in communities, we're in a position to be able to identify people who would be great in office.
Right. And I just joined the PTO and like all the drama even involved with that, I can't imagine running for Congress. Like it's,
well, listen, let me just tell you, I was a PTO mom for about 8 years when my kids were in elementary school. I had to quit when both of them, when my second one went to middle school, because they forbade me from ever coming inside the middle school again. You know, they were like, you did your time, mom. In the elementary school, you were not coming into the middle school. I don't ever want to see you there. And you're right. The politics of PTOs is a good training ground for a politician.
Yeah.
we talked a little, I mean, we've talked a little bit about, you know, some negative things or doom and gloom a little bit here, but looking forward, Lehigh Valley for you, like what are some of your hopes in the future, 5 years, 10 years? I don't know. Like what do you see happening or some good things?
So I moved to the Lehigh Valley in 1987, which is, I don't know, you guys do the math, 35 years ago, I think. But anyway, and by the way, I still had people calling me a carpetbagger when I ran for Congress. Like, that's a long time. But as you know, Lehigh Valley standards, people lived here for generations. But what we're seeing is the Lehigh Valley considerably more diverse, because we're the fastest growing region in Pennsylvania and have been for some time now. And that's all, I think, really good for our community. I think it makes it a really interesting place to live. We, you know, when I first moved here, man, finding good restaurants was not always the easiest thing to do. Now it's like, I've only got 20 to pick from on any Saturday night that I might really like to go to, which is great. And it's also made our schools much more diverse. And so I love the growth. At the same time, I am very cognizant of urban sprawl. I'm very cognizant of the houses and how people feel. It's, you know, the NIMBY problem, not in my backyard. And while those warehouses actually have raised the wages in the Lehigh Valley, because I think Amazon was the first to go to $20 an hour. And guess what? That's not too uncommon now, even outside the warehouse sector. You know, we really have to remember that one of the main attractions of the Lehigh Valley is how beautiful it is, the natural resources that really, we don't want to turn it into a suburb of Philadelphia, in my view. You know, I mean, Philadelphia is great. We don't want to be a suburb of Philadelphia. So I really want to see us do some sensible planning. I think there's some people working hard on that. But at the same time, I think economic is development is great. Economic development, you know, these manufacturing facilities really, yes, really have helped our community get higher wages, yeah, and good jobs.
Susan, this has been fantastic. This has been a fantastic discussion here. And George and I, we so very much appreciate you taking the time,
yes, as thank you are
working on advocacy within our communities and looking to do some good things here in the Lehigh Valley. So we thank you so much, yeah, for taking the time.
Thank you for giving me appreciate the time. It was a pleasure talking to you. I could have talked all afternoon.
Next time.
No, I'm just kidding. I don't want to talk all afternoon. And more than that, your listeners don't want me to talk all afternoon. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Tell Zoe we said hello, and hopefully we'll yes, see you again sometime
soon. She's exhausted. So she just had a nice long dog walk.
Nice.
See ya.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.